The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
On to our next guest of the day, and that would be Fadel Gate. He is certainly one of the best-known oil analysts on Wall Street. He's managing director and senior analyst of the oil and gas research at Oppenheimer & Co. Fadel, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
So here we are at $102 a barrel on West Texas Intermediate.
I don't know if we should celebrate or ask for more, but the $100 oil obviously came because of what's happening in the Middle East.
Is it a kind of a trader-driven market today? Is it a news-driven market today? What's going on?
Well, it's always the market is moving on perception and expectations, and obviously we have plenty to worry about, to concern ourselves with supply disruption from the Middle East. Obviously, it could shoot oil prices to a much higher level, and it's a domino effect. It will impact inflation. It will impact consumer confidence, and definitely would stifle economic growth. So the market has every reason to worry about what's happening in the Middle East, and obviously it is, you know, headlines all the time.
And, of course, one of our headlines is Libya crisis ignites African Caspian oil prices. Taken in there, and a big concern, I guess, people are looking at what's going on with how you're going to replace disrupted Libyan exports. They're looking at Nigeria, all kinds of questions.
Right. Libya itself is not a major player or a major factor. Obviously, it's an OPEC country. It produces about 1.8 million barrels per day. But I think the market is more concerned with what if the unrest spread to other countries. Basically, although people don't say it up front, it's Saudi Arabia. It is the world gas tank, if you will.
And I love that, the world gas tank. Yes,
yeah,
that's,
I mean, it's basically, it is the world gas station, and whether we like it or not, it is what it is. Saudi Arabia produces a significant amount of oil, almost 9 million barrels a day. That is five times as much as the Libyan oil output. So any notion for disruption in the flow of oil from Saudi Arabia will carry a lot more impact than what's happening in Libya or Egypt or Tunisia or whatever. They are not players at all. We've seen what's happening in Bahrain, which is just a causeway 12 miles or so from Saudi Arabia, and then what we're seeing in Oman, and we're seeing, or these are all neighboring countries. They share, obviously, a common border with Saudi Arabia. So the market has every reason to be concerned. And as long as this is going on, oil traders were not going to miss this chance and will keep pushing oil prices higher.
Now, when we last spoke, it was in the last few days before Hosni Mubarak finally gave up power in Egypt. And at the time, you were optimistic that he would, optimistic that this would be a productive development for that country, that it would be relatively peaceful. As you see the civil war in Libya now, as you see the, you know, demonstrations in Bahrain, as you look at these other countries, what's your assessment of the region and the forces?
Well, not very good. Obviously, they all have the same problems, if you will. The only difference between the rulers of these countries, they all dictators, obviously. They are all corrupt. They are all ruthless. But the difference between Mubarak and Gaddafi is Gaddafi is insane. He is totally crazy, and nothing is ruled out. He killed his own people. He will do a lot of atrocity. He is Saddam Hussein, number two. So these people, unfortunately, they only know one language, and this is, has to be war and violence and bloodshed. So I hope that that would not spread. I hope it becomes more peaceful in the rest of the Middle East. It is much needed. These people are so oppressed. And hopefully, if the transition in this country goes smoother and more peaceful, I think the world will be better off. These people will be better off. I think oil and gas prices will probably come down. I think they're going to open up to foreign capital, Western societies and ideas and whatever. So I think it is very positive. Unfortunately, before we celebrate the transition, we have to witness what's happening in Libya right now, massacres and bloodshed of innocent people. And unfortunately, the world has to move faster to just stop that.
You know, throughout this period, we don't know how long it's going to last, but it looks like a lot of this is going to be with us for a while, I guess I'm trying to say. Middle East uprising. Let's call it the big theme. In the midst of Middle East uprising, how high can crude oil prices go?
It will go up gradually depending on which regime will fall next or if we have any disturbances in any of these countries, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia. Before the break, I was telling you that I have a correspondent from somebody in the region telling me that there is a call for demonstrations in Saudi Arabia Friday the 11th. And that is, it seems to me that is the theme. They go after the Friday prayer and they demonstrate. We are beginning to see that is more of a common theme throughout the whole region. Their grievances, their inequality, they have, and the Saudi king, what he did a couple of weeks ago is that he opened the purse and he is going to dole out $40 billion to the people. But that, I think this is a band-aid. I think it's not going to cure anything. It's not going to change anything. They lack basic freedoms. These people have cell phone and Blackberries and satellite dishes, and you know what the rest of the world has and they don't have. So they will obviously demand for these freedoms that they don't have and they don't know of.
So in that environment, it seems to me that you're suggesting that maybe not tomorrow, maybe not this Friday, but we are going to see more Saudis pushing for more democracy.
Absolutely. There is no question in my mind. I mean, you have incredible large percentage of population, younger people. They are not obvious the old folks. They are internet savvy. They know exactly what's going on. And you cannot keep them in the dark much longer. And you see what happened in Egypt, which was purely peaceful. There is no need for violence. We are expressing our views, and we need to regain our freedom. And so it is, in my view, it's not if, it's when. And the level of transition, whether it's going to be violent one or it's going to be peaceful one. I think the sooner the better we see transition, because the sooner it happens, there will be less violence. But if they try to basically stifle the opposition and do what they have been doing for the last few decades, I think it's going to backfire. I think it's going to end up very badly for everybody. And unfortunately, the rest of the world is going to suffer, because I guarantee you, if we have a serious supply interruption from this part of the world, we are going to see oil prices much higher than the peak we had in 2008. And with all due respect to the chairman of the Fed chairman,
Ben Bernanke.
When oil prices go to $150, all bets are off and inflation will be real. It was not going to be, it's going to be a nightmare. I mean, we're really seeing food prices moving much higher. fire in Asia, and that's one of the reasons that the Chinese government is trying to cool off the economy, because food price inflation will hurt the poor people more, and these are the people who are unhappy to start with.
Okay, but I have to ask you a question, because I think it's very important. We're going to have Brian Koutoulas from the Center for American Progress earlier or on later in the show. But, you know, you're Egyptian, you're Egyptian-American, I should say. You studied engineering in Cairo years ago. What can the U.S. do now in the midst of all this? What should the U.S. be doing?
Number one, we stop coddling and dealing with dictators, for heaven's sake. And if we want to befriend them, we tell them, you better ship up and clean up, or you're going to be messing up everything. That's what we should have been doing for many years. I mean, we keep, you know, every time I see clips of what happened in the last 5 years, Tony Blair goes to Libya and hug Gaddafi and whatever. Everybody knows that the man is crazy, and we're going there because to get access to his oil. But at least we should have the courage to tell him, you know, you better behave like a human being before we do business with you.
So you think, is the U.S. on track now?
Well, I mean, we were hedging our bets with Egypt, and instead of, you know, we're supporting Mubarak until we saw clearly the writing was on the wall. And the best thing we could do right now is to use whatever persuasion or goodwill or whatever to tell these people to quickly, you know, change things around before it's too late. Because we really cannot help these people. I mean, we can protect these countries from outside invasion, whatever, but we can't protect them from their own people. And basically, that's what we have right now. It is an internal revolution. Mm-hmm. It's not an outside threat.
Fadlgate, we look forward to having you back very soon. We already spoke with Fadlgate. He's the director of oil and gas research at Oppenheimer & Co., a man who was born in Egypt, has been certainly spending his adult professional life here, but very passionate, very well-informed on what's going on in that part of the world. We want to bring in someone now who can really help us dig deeper into this story, and particularly from the point of view of U.S. policy, how it is adjusting rapidly to the tectonic shifts in this region. Brian Koutoulas is senior fellow at American Progress. His work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. Brian, welcome to the Hayes Advantage.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. The couple of the pieces I read from you recently, as I said, focused a lot on how the U.S. has had to just suddenly, you know, in midstream, you know, kind of, I don't want to say making it up as it goes, but big foreign policy challenges for the U.S. and no time to think about it. Just jump in and act. Are we on the right track now?
I think so far they've struck the right balance in what is a very complicated and fast-moving situation throughout the region. You know, I've been critical of my friends in the Obama administration on how they handled the Arab-Israeli peace process, and I think they've made some bad mistakes on the Afghanistan war. In this instance, I actually think in the Middle East uprisings, they've done as best as one can, given how dynamic the situation is on the ground, trying to strike the right balance between our security interests and the obvious need for change and reform in many countries in the Middle East.
Well, and it is a big shift, isn't it? As Fadlgate, I asked him, what does the U.S. need to do now? What should it do? And he just, stop supporting dictators in the Middle East. That was his very adamant, very, you know, passionate statement as someone
right.
who is, you know, from there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the sentiment, and I worked and lived in the Middle East for 5 years, and I do think we have this addiction to autocrats, but what Fadl said is easier said than done, because if you look at the range of interests that we have, I would put counterterrorism and the threat of terrorist attacks up there. I would put reasonable oil prices. I would also put the threat of civil wars and insurgencies. This means that we actually, you know, I do think we need to move beyond simply picking and choosing a leader of a country and backing him. But as we execute this transition, or as the region executes this transition, because they're pushing it, we need to make sure that we're diversifying our contacts and doing it in a way that it doesn't, you know, throw people under the bus that we need to cooperate with on counterterrorism and dealing with Al-Qaeda or making sure that a civil war doesn't break out. So I think I agree with the sentiment, but I think it's a much more complicated and nuanced thing that they're trying to pull off here.
I understand that. And in fact, I have a tendency to be sort of starry-eyed and optimistic on all this and idealistic, and I realize there are a lot of powerful forces at play, and now there's so many kind of factions that are going to be unleashed. But kind of a big picture question here that I've been wondering about for the last month. Has there been kind of a subtle prejudice against the Arab world in this country, in the West? Is that one of the reasons why it was so easy to miss that maybe at some point people would say, we don't want to live this way, we don't want to live under dictators, that we somehow discounted all these people?
I don't know if it's prejudice. I just think that we've gotten into this business of doing conducting affairs in the Middle East the way we've done it for a long period of time. And there have been warning signals as early as 10, 15 years ago where the UN Arab Human Development Report talked about all of these crushing demographic, social, and economic problems the countries were facing, and their governments weren't responding to it. So I think there was what you hear in terms of people not willing to move beyond, say, the Saudi regime or move beyond the powers that be is that it leads to uncertainty. That uncertainty leads to risks. That risk leads to things like, you know, $100 a barrel of oil. So I think there's a tendency to just continue on in the status quo, even though the status quo, as we see, is not sustainable. So I don't know if it's, you know, there are some people who say, well, the Arabs are not ready for democracy. And that's completely ridiculous. I think people want a decent life. They want to have a voice in how their government does things. And actually, I think, you know, what we're looking at is a long period of transition for this part of the world.
Well, of course, you said you've been critical of your friends in the Obama administration, how they've dealt with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or peace process, depending on how you want to depict it. And of course, again, it seems that's another reason why this has been off the radar screen, maybe not at the UN, maybe not for experts in the region like you, the fact that there might be some yearning for economic prosperity, if not democracy itself in the Middle East. But the focus the focus on Israel and the Palestinians, that seemed to define so many people's view of the dynamics in the region. And we know, did the uprising in Egypt have anything to do with that? Most people say no, it's not about religion, it's about what Egyptians want for themselves.
Yes.
And so where do we stand now in terms of the dynamic in the Middle East? How is it now? I mean, again, that did seem defining for a lot of people. Is that really changed now? How does it fit into the picture?
Well, I think I would say you could take two approaches to this and say, well, it's less likely that there'll be a Arab-Israeli peace agreement as a result of this because it just becomes all the more complicated. We don't know who's going to be leading some of these countries who already have peace agreements with Israel or who might be leading countries who don't have peace agreements yet. I take a separate view, which I actually think the Arab-Israeli conflict, as complicated as it's been and it's hard to resolve, looks easier in terms of, compared to these crushing social, economic, and demographic problems the Middle East is facing. And it would do the Israelis and the Palestinians well, and some of the neighboring countries, to get more serious about resolving the conflict, in part because the ongoing unresolved conflict fuels some of the worst extremists. We've seen terrorists attack U.S. troops motivated by the unresolved Arab-Israeli conflict. And it also has been used as an excuse by some leaders in the region to not resolve some of the problems that people are protesting about. I mean, just today, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who's the Yemen president, has blamed Israel for the problems that his country is facing in terms of the unrest, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, it's the head in the sand, using as an excuse the unresolved conflict. My view is, let's take it off the table. I think even in this turmoil, the United States might do well to try to get the Israelis and Palestinians, as difficult as it is, to actually resolve that which they, I think, came close to resolving several times over the last 10 years.
I want to ask you another question that has to do with Iran, because, of course, that's what a lot of people's concern is now. And this faithful listener notes some comments from Dr. George Friedman, Stratfor. I'm sure you've heard of them. He was on the show, I believe, week before last. And he suggests, Friedman that is, that the unrest in the Middle East is not about freedom, Twitter, or Facebook. It's about Iran projecting its power in the region to get control. Friedman also suggests Saudi Arabia was stable because its security was predicated on either the UK or US protecting them, and that may no longer be the case. Let's start with the Iran question.
Well, I think a lot of analysts are projecting sort of their own frameworks for on these events. And I think Iran, one debate people have been having is whether they win or lose as a result of this uprising. And I think it's really simplistic to say that Iran is benefiting at this stage, in part because I think Iran's own power and its influence in the region was really harmed by the way that it brutally cracked down on its own protesters back in 2009. And they continue to repress its own people to this day. So I find it hard to imagine that Egyptians or Libyans or others who are facing the same type of repression from their own regimes that are similar to what Iran's doing to its own people would look favorably on Iran. I just think it's really simplistic. And I also think it's just, we're at the early stage, I want to highlight this again, of a transition in the region. It's very, very early. And I think when you look at some of the voices that are emerging from Islamist politics in the Arab world, which is largely Sunni Islam, though there are some differences in places like Bahrain, it's not, we look for sort of domino theories and very simplistic conceptions of waves that are crashing over the region. And I actually think what we're seeing is a much more complicated process, and it's way too early to tell whether any country like Iran or the United States stand to gain from or lose from the changes that are emerging.
More complicated process, in a nutshell, what is it?
Well, it's people who are tired of the old order that has not delivered on their basic needs.
Brian, let's look at Saudi Arabia. You mentioned the Day of Rage, they're calling it, scheduled, I believe, for this Friday. And again, with reference to the question that came in for a listener who was on a listening to a conference call with George Friedman at Stratfor, where Dr. Friedman's view is that Saudi Arabia was stable in the past because its security was predicated on either the UK or US protecting them, and that that may no longer be the case. Do you agree with this?
In large part, but increasingly Saudi Arabia has taken over control of its own affairs. Since 2003, the U.S. really has not had much of a presence inside of Saudi Arabia and a security presence. People did not notice this that much because the strong story in 2003 was the Iraq War. But right before that, the U.S. had basically drawn down its true presence, which had been very strong since the 1991 Gulf War. And we have had several $1 billion of arms sales. And in fact, one of the largest military sales that's proposed right now in the history of the United States is with Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. has played a supporting role over the last 7 or 8 years, and Saudis have taken over their own affairs. But who knows how they're going to be able to deal with this unrest. The king came back from being outside of the country for 3 months earlier last week, and he announced a stimulus package, a social welfare package of about $37 billion aimed at dealing with some of the economic problems Saudis are facing. And as we see, the Facebook protest calls, there's also been a prominent group of intellectuals who have called for a constitutional monarchy and political reform. It looks like Saudi Arabia, which has 20% of the world's proven oil reserves, may be entering the same sort of process that Egypt and Yemen and others are starting to face already. And I think that should raise some more alarm bells. I think change and reform is good. We should expect it. But hopefully it doesn't result in some sort of uncontrollable unrest.
Who's driving? Who's in charge of U.S. policy in the Middle East now? Hillary Clinton is the Secretary of State. But earlier this week, Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., was out front denouncing Gaddafi. I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, well, they have many different people who are speaking, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because they're, for the most part, singing from the same sheet of music. The president is setting the policy with his national security advisor, Tom Donilon, who has over the last week or two adopted a more a higher public profile. But Tom has been sort of the maestro conducting everything behind the scenes here throughout these uprisings. And I think Susan Rice is a very important voice, in part not only because she's the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but that she has long experience in dealing with humanitarian situations and crises of the sort that I think is unfolding in Libya and on the borders that Libya shares with Egypt and Tunisia. So having sort of this sense of a full court press in terms of who's talking publicly, I think is a very good thing. But, you know, let's be clear, it's the president because who's driving this policy.
He is the president of the United States, after all. Let's get to a point you made in your piece just over a week ago, looking at the challenges for the administration. You say, in addition to the new uprisings, the administration will need to continue dealing with the other major challenges that existed long before the uprisings, the Arab-Israeli conflict, Iran's nuclear problem, Iraq's reintegration into the Middle East, ongoing threats from terrorist groups in the region. And you conclude this piece by saying it's going to occupy a lot more time and attention.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the very interesting thing. If the top priorities of the administration on foreign policy were Afghanistan and Pakistan in the first year and a half, it seems like, you know, no matter whether Obama's a one-termer or a two-termer, at least for the rest of 2011 and through 2012, these uprisings in the Middle East and the change that's coming is probably going to be front and center on his agenda. And the challenges, and I mentioned this in the piece, on his multitasking just got even harder.
Mm-hmm.
Because things like terrorism, things like the Iranian nuclear program, things like the fact that we still have nearly 200,000 U.S. troops in the broader Middle East, all of those fundamentals, I think, are going to be there. And you add to that list the fact that we still have a growing or continued economic crisis here at home, which will probably be exacerbated by these high oil prices, too.
Talk to us about ACAP, Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. This is, you're talking about the continued threats from terrorist groups.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is seen by our intelligence community and John Brennan, the top White House counterterrorism advisor, as the most urgent threat to U.S. homeland security, even more so than the Al-Qaeda presence in Pakistan, where Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri are, and even more so than Afghanistan. These were the guys who, there were several plots inside of the U.S., and I think we might expect more that have been orchestrated by this branch of the Al-Qaeda movement. The fact that Yemen is experiencing internal turmoil, which, you know, it's experienced internal turmoil for a long while now, and it had a long civil war back in the 1980s and 90s. But this is rising to a new level. And if the Yemeni government becomes increasingly unstable, I think that'll further complicate our efforts to deal with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Just before all of this unrest, we had increased our security cooperation with the Yemeni security forces to try to go after the Al-Qaeda networks. And if you look at today's New York Times, the front page above the fold article is about a radical cleric who is demanding the ouster of Yemen's leader. So this is yet another sort of complicated challenge in Yemen and coming from terrorist groups that we need to keep our eye on.
You know, I hate to make light of this, but when we talk about multitasking for the administration in the Middle East, all I can think of is that definition of multitasking, doing more things at once and giving yourself more opportunities to screw them up.
Yeah. And the thing is also that we have to adopt a posture where we have to recognize that we can shape, we can influence, and we can try to encourage others in terms of shaping outcomes, but we're not going to be able to control the situation.
Brian Katulis, thanks for joining us. First time on the show. I hope you'll come
right
back. Thanks so much.
Happy to. Bye-bye.
Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow at American Progress.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keene and listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on satellite radio, Sirius Channel 130 and XM Channel 129. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.